All right, well, good morning, everyone. Wow, you're a vocal group in Belgium. Everyone just sat there when I said good morning. And I'm like, wow, you're a really welcoming group. It's great to be here. It's a little bit early, so I think people are still going to kind of be filtering in, but that's okay. This session is all about application compatibility, and it is specifically targeted towards nerds. So if you are a project manager, this is probably not going to be your thing. But I am going to give you some advice upon how we, as the nerds of the world, can help our project managers avoid doing things that are crazy. And there are a lot of things that end up happening because project managers are trying to overmanage their risk. And they're being too cautious sometimes. And when we look at how much time we have left, you know, I had to try to think of what's the nerdiest way that I could... Oh, I can't run Windows 8 apps. Well, I got Live Tiles. How could I demonstrate how much time we have left? So I wrote a Windows 8 app. But in order to get onto the screen at the right resolution, I actually can't run a Windows 8 app. But there are 396 days left. And with 396 days left, we have to figure out some way to get there as quickly as we can. So before we go into the troubleshooting part, which is going to be a big component of our session today, I do want to talk about how the nerds can help earlier on to help the people who are running this project make smarter decisions. So let's first of all kind of talk about some of the mathematical realities that we're facing when we're dealing with app compat and how we can help to understand the impact of those realities. Here's what I mean. With the help of nothing more than a calculator, I've stopped people from doing some very silly things. For example, I had a customer who said, I want to follow the practice, incidentally, the practice that we advertise inside of the application compatibility toolkit, which says it's a three-step process, really easy. Inventory, find all the stuff that you have. Rationalize, cross off all the stuff you know you don't care about, and then do your testing. That's the process even we as Microsoft advocate as part of the product. And if you think about that from a Windows installed application perspective, you can mostly get away with it. But the customers that I talk to aren't just upgrading the platform on which their installed Windows applications run. They are also upgrading their web browser, which is part of that platform, and they're usually upgrading their version of Office as well. And if I take, for example, just the web browser component, what's an inventory of a web browser look like? Well, add-ins is one, and typically you don't get too many add-ins. But what about unique URLs? How do you tell which URL represents a unique website? And it turns out that there's no algorithm that lets you do that. You have to inspect them. Well, what's the cost of simply doing a thorough inventory and finding that out? Well, the typical enterprise ends up visiting somewhere on the order of 200 million unique URLs when measured over a suitable time frame to get a good representation. 200 million. So if I decide that I would like to take this and rationalize it, let's compute the cost of rationalizing such an inventory, right? We're nerds, so we can do math. So 200 million, let's say I'm going to spend 5 minutes looking at each of those, or 0.08 hours, and I'm going to pay a vendor 100 euros an hour to do that work for me and do that rationalization because I don't have enough people, and suddenly, before I've done any compatibility work, I'm submitting a bill for 1.6 billion euros. And suddenly, that doesn't seem like such a good idea. In the world of Office documents, Office typically has around 25 million unique documents in a typical enterprise. So it's an order of magnitude lower. It's still hundreds of millions of dollars if I take that approach. So as we are working with our project managers to make a sensible project plan, we need to do that math for them and make sure that they understand they're dealing with the law of large numbers. They cannot be perfectionists. They particularly cannot be perfectionists because Alan Turing, way back in 1936, proved that it's mathematically impossible for us to do a perfect job. So the entire endeavor is a probabilistic exercise. We're all about maximizing our probabilities. So as I start thinking about what is the approach that we should be taking, the taxonomy, and architects love to talk about taxonomy, so this gives you some ammunition to talk to the architects. The taxonomy I like to use is this. It's one that divides the world into four categories of applications. First, the managed applications. Second, the supported. Third, unsupported. And finally, banned. So banned are those applications that you would do things like apply app locker policies against to prevent them from running. Right? Some organizations have a lot of them. Most organizations I work with just don't have any. They're not to that point where they're going to actively stop things from running. But when we talk about app compat, what we really care about are those applications which are managed, that we're going to make a commitment to testing before we change the platform. And there ought to be a process by which a business unit or a developer team can submit them to the IT pros to be managed. If there is no process, it's not very fair. You're providing an insurance policy, and they've never paid a premium. In fact, they've never even told you that you're insuring it. Because if you think about it, that's really how most compatibility projects run. What works? I don't know. What do you have? I don't know. So you're insuring what you don't even know exists. So job number one is find out what you're on the hook to insure, and second, deliver on the insurance policy. That's what we want to try to move away from. We think about managed. Those are the ones I'm looking at proactively. There's a second category called supported. Those are the ones where if you have a problem, you can call us and we'll fix them. Those are the ones that we find during pilot deployments. One of my favorite methods of deployment from a statistical perspective is the gradually expanding pilot. Start running some people, and if the support lines still have capacity, deploy it faster. If they don't have capacity, deploy it slower. And work it that way. But this helps you deal with reality, particularly in the world of Office. In the world of Office, nearly every document out there is what we would call a supported document or potentially unsupported. So maybe someone's resume you wouldn't actively help them fix. But a business document, you wouldn't want to test them all. 25 million? You can't test them all. There's no realistic way to do it. So the question then comes back, well, this assumes that there's a lot of work and a lot of expense around what are we doing that. Well, what about tools? And how do tools simplify that? They're going to come to the nerds, us, and ask about the tools and ask us to evaluate them. And we evaluate them by the exact same criteria. How are they going to help me manage the statistics of application compatibility? So let's first talk a little bit about what we do in the world of Microsoft and the Application Compatibility Toolkit, which is what we provide. And when we look at what we found with versions 5.0 through 5.6, the ones that we've shipped from Windows Vista through Windows 7, back then, if you're familiar with those tools, what we provided was the ability to not only collect an inventory, right? And on Windows apps, you can kind of get away with that. The largest inventory I've ever seen of installed Windows apps is 130,000 unique applications, which is kind of frighteningly big, but still, you can get your way through that. Millions and hundreds of millions, you really can't, but 100,000, you can. So we provide the inventory, and we provided a technology that allowed you to do some compatibility evaluation of the programs while they're running on XP to predict whether they would have a problem running on Windows Vista at first and then Windows 7 to try and tell you. And what we found when we analyzed, hey, what did our detection tell you versus what did your testing tell you, is that our accuracy on an issue-by-issue basis was pretty high. If we said, you have this problem, it was always because we saw you having that problem at runtime. Runtime evaluators are more accurate because we know you ran the code and we know the code hit that problem. So that accuracy was terrific. But it turns out that absolutely nobody cares about that accuracy. What they care about is, does the app work? Yes or no? They like the concept of the red, amber, or green status. And really, red-green. Red, does it break? Green, does it work? Amber is sort of this in-between, I don't know state. And when we look at how do those compatibility evaluators work when it comes to determining does the application as a whole work or not, the dozen or so tests that we ran turned out to be not terribly predictive of whether or not the application as a whole would work. So if your intent was to generate a list of does it work or does it not work, turns out we do about as well as chance at telling you whether or not the application as a whole would work or not. So you could either invest in bringing in some expensive consultants to set up an ACT infrastructure and do compatibility evaluation, or you can get a local high school student and have them flip a coin, and you could expect roughly the same outcome. So given that, we decided, you know what? Let's not keep delivering that if it's making customers sad. Because the most common use for the compatibility evaluator data that we collected in ACT was for someone to invest a lot of money, collect it, stick it into a database, take the database, put it in the back corner of the basement, kind of like this room, and never look at it again between now and the end of time. That's what most people did with it. So we got rid of it. It didn't make sense for us to go through and do that work. And instead, go ahead and launch the Application Compatibility Manager. We said rather than having you try to predict it and predict poorly, no one wins because who would suspect that we would be doing a bad job at it, right? We did a good job at the wrong thing. Turns out that's not good enough. So we instead said we will continue to provide inventory. That is of value to a lot of people who don't know what they're running. So we continue to provide inventory in Act 6.0. So this is the Application Compatibility Manager from Act 6.0. And if you've not found Act 6, that's because it's no longer a separate download. It's now a part of the Windows Assessment and Deployment Kit, or ADK. It's one of the installation components, along with the Microsoft Deployment Toolkit and several other tools. So we give you the inventory. We also give you the ability to match up to vendor assessment, right? So this goes into the back-end database where we try to consolidate as much data as we can on whether the vendor is claiming support for the application. On a typical inventory, we tend to hit between 6 and 12% of the third-party applications with the vendor data from an expectation standpoint. Rather unfortunately, since we're not in an English-speaking country right now, we do better at English language apps because the people who are consolidating this list are a bunch of people sitting in Redmond, Washington, the middle of an English-speaking country. That doesn't mean we are exclusive for English-speaking apps. That's just a saying, my experience is we have higher match rates in English-speaking countries, and we have way higher match rates when there is not a different alphabet. So in Asia, the match rates tend to be even lower. But still, it can save you some time. So that is there. The down-level evaluators, however, have been removed because they don't help you. What we did instead was we replaced the down-level evaluators with an up-level evaluator. In other words, this directly supports pilot users as well as user acceptance testing. So we will collect some data that is technically based data, saying, hey, we hit a problem here, we'll go ahead and report this. The application crashed. It actually plugs directly into the program compatibility assistant, which we made a lot of investments in for Windows 8. So the program compatibility assistant is a feature that we added for Windows Vista, initially trying to resolve a lot of the problems that existed around particularly user account control. And it keeps getting smarter and smarter. For example, in Windows 8, the program compatibility assistant will check for dialog boxes that mention things like I require Windows XP SP2 or SP3. It actually reads the contents of message boxes and raises alerts when it matches those strings saying, I wish I were this old version of the operating system, simply because they are incredibly common. Let's find them all. In addition to finding some technical data, we also make it very easy to collect data from users who are testing and signing off on the application. This was a real common request, which is we make it very difficult to gather and consolidate information. So if I hit a problem and I want to open a bug, right? Historically, I would maybe enter it into ACT, although most of the customers I talk to don't end up doing that, right? They end up getting their inventory and typically dropping it into Excel or SharePoint, so not a lot of people use it. But as we add capabilities, I'm starting to see people leverage the ACT to manage the process. Because in addition to simply having the inventory and my checklist, now we can do things like add a screenshot. Here's the problem if you're having a problem reproducing it. Or adding a step-by-step recording. This is just the problem step recorder that we added for Windows 7. But instead of having these things emailed around, which is what happened back in the Windows 7 days, now it's sitting in the same database with the rest of your stuff. So the approach has changed. We start you with inventory, but then we really focus on making UAT, the test that really matters, happen with a lot less friction. And that is helping to really accelerate things. And this same process has been applied in the world of Office. So if you did a migration to Office 2010 or were piloting that concept, in Office 2010 we had a collection of three tools that we provided to assist with those migrations. The Office Migration Planning Manager, or OMPM, the Office Environment Assessment Tool, OEAT, and the Office Code Compatibility Inspector, or OCCI. And they were very focused on, let me just find all of your documents and let me predict whether or not they work. And that prediction had a lot of the same challenges that we see in the world of the web or in the world of Windows, which is a lot of things are very highly non-deterministic. We can guess and say, oh, yeah, it looks like this one might be a problem, but if we alert you to all of those, it'll be like the boy who cried wolf, if you know that story. Hey, here's potentially a problem, right? And we'll see where we have issue detection flagging 30 to 40% of documents as potentially problematic. And the reality is that it's somewhere around 2% of the typical document inventory has some kind of problem, most of them minor. So the remaining 28 to 38% are all false alarms. And in the scope of millions, that's a lot of false alarms. So that's what we want to try to avoid, is trying to detect that. So we got rid of all of those tools as well. They're gone. and replaced them with a feature called telemetry, which, number one, focuses on not just inventory of what documents have people put onto a file share somewhere that I can get a complete directory listing of, but focuses on what items are showing up in a user's MRU list, or most recently used, to indicate that at least they're being opened. Because I don't know about you, I did an actual inventory of my documents alone, just me, personally, on my machine. I had 20,000 that I had created over the course of the past however many years I've been saving documents. I'm a little bit old, so that's been a while. I've had a head start on a lot of folks. Nonetheless, the number of those 20,000 that I'm likely to open between now and the day that I die is probably a couple dozen. And the rest I will never open again. So any work that we did to see if these were compatible or not will be wasted effort. Which is why we focus on MRU. So it's that approach, that statistical approach, and being willing to feel a little bit dirty about the approaches you use. We're technologists. We like using technology and automation. But one of my favorite quotes, and I actually can't determine whether or not this is a real quote or a made-up quote. That's sort of the problem these days with the internet. People quote things and attribute them to people. Apparently, this is attributed to Bill Gates. I cannot verify whether or not it's true. But to me, it makes a lot of sense. If you automate an efficient process, you magnify its efficiency. If you automate an inefficient process, you magnify its inefficiency. And that's what we want to avoid. If it's cheaper to have someone do something manually, that's what we need to do. And it's that kind of decision that ends up being hard. When we look at, you know, what is the actual risk that we're trying to manage, most people start off with an equation that looks something like this. The cost of failure of any application anywhere is approximately equal to infinity, in which case you manage things very, very differently. Nothing can fail. But here's what the real equation looks like. The cost of failure times the probability of failure needs to be greater than the cost of testing. If it is not greater than the cost of testing, then you shouldn't test it. Now, what does this figure mean? We'll stop doing math in just a minute, so if anyone's eyes are glazing over like, wow, really, you're doing math at 9:30 in the morning? We're not going to do that the whole time, but we do need to get things started right, which is why I like to spend a little bit of time talking about this. What's the probability of failure? I mentioned one already, right? Statistically speaking, on a worldwide average, again, you could be luckier or you could be less lucky. Statistically speaking, Office documents fail about 2% of the time on an upgrade from 2003 to either 2010 or 2013. So it's pretty low. You have to have a pretty high cost of failure to justify testing it proactively. In the world of Windows, when we started back in the initial days of Windows Vista, we don't like to say these numbers. I'll go ahead and say them because they're true, and you can find out yourself by simply doing the upgrade. It started off at around 30%. So not quite a third, but awfully close to a third of people's stuff you had to do something about. On an upgrade from Windows XP to Windows 7 today, what we're seeing is more like 21 to 22%. And that number's going down mostly because people have just bought newer versions of their third-party software that happens to be compatible. Not on purpose, just purely by accident. They weren't planning on it. Most of the challenge remains in in-house software because the developers inside are still using Windows XP and therefore haven't needed to change. That's why my number one recommendation from a deployment strategy is get your new platform into the hands of developers as soon as you can. That way they can start making new applications that work in that environment. The probability of failure for anyone coming from IE6 to IE8, the applications that break, average around 25%. Conveniently, most of those are really easy to fix. Most of those, we have a document mode that will get them back working again. And we'll talk about that when we get into IE troubleshooting. So that's kind of your probabilities. And we can look at any individual scenario, right? One scenario that people are starting to get interested in now is, what about a transition from Windows 7 to Windows 8? What do we see there? Now, the data there is still too early for me to be pumping out numbers. What we've seen in very early numbers is about 8% of applications needing to be touched. Most of those are packaging failures. So it's not the way that the vendor shipped them. They don't fail to run. They're just packaged incorrectly in some way that has a dependency. A lot of that is, I checked the box in App V, as one example, that says only run it on Windows 7, which means App V goes ahead and enforces that and only runs it on Windows 7. In fact, nearly all of the failures that we've seen have been version checks. The app works fine if it didn't have a version check. My favorite was one set of applications that was in response to a major printer driver where every single binary that they had in there had a version check in it. So it was, I was shimming all over the place to do version lies to get them working. But that's our primary culprit now, is not that they don't natively work. A lot of the investment in Windows 8 wasn't, let's reinvent desktop apps. It was, let's kind of leave desktop apps alone. We still need them. They still have their place. Let's invest in building a whole new category of apps, which means we didn't change a lot about desktop apps other than the version of Windows. And finally, I'll talk briefly about the cost of testing, and this is something to also manage mathematically, which is there are a number of tools that can help you accelerate the cost of testing, but just do the math. Right, so when we look at it, right, depending upon where the resources are coming from, those automation tools can help make testing cost less. And in some cases, the tools, the licensing can cost more than having a human do it, particularly when I'm doing offshore. I just want to make sure that I do the math and make the right decision. So, I think that's about enough math. But with those principles in mind, you can help guide the team running this project to make much smarter choices around what they should be pursuing. So let's fast forward now. We're in the middle of the project. We're running along, and we're starting to get issues that are coming up, whether from applications that we're testing proactively and that we found data suggesting, or from applications that we are just running in pilot and someone's called them in. What are the problems and how do we troubleshoot them? So when it comes to troubleshooting, I'm going to start off looking at web applications first and make sure that everyone understands all of the tools that you have at your disposal, both as part of the platform as well as troubleshooting tools. So to start off with, the number one most misunderstood aspect of compatibility for IE is that there is not just a single IE. Internet Explorer is kind of the shell that contains multiple personalities of IE. If I push F12, which opens the developer tools for IE, I can get a view into what those different personalities are. And in fact, we've done this since Internet Explorer 6. We just didn't provide a UI for you to see this. And in fact, we only exposed it to the developer. So way back when, When IE6 first came out, we made a big investment in standards. Right? It kind of sounds funny now, because if someone were to say, you know what, what's a really good standards-compliant browser, IE6 does not usually come to mind. Usually about the opposite comes to mind. But we're thinking about this from a 2013 perspective. Which browser had the highest standards compliance in 1998? It was IE. IE5 had the highest standards compliance. IE5.5 had the highest standards compliance. Then IE6 had the highest standards compliance. And in fact, it was so high that we thought that we were going to break the web if we shipped it that way. Because existing websites were created expecting the non-compliance in the ways that we had fixed to make them standards compliance. That's the catch-22. You can want standards compliance to always be getting better, but what you're asking for when you request that is to please break all of my websites built on the non-compliant version. How do you do both? How do you make the purists who want standards compliance, because we think it's good, standards compliance is good, how do we make them happy without breaking everything that's already been written? We did that by saying, you know what? Let's keep what we had in IE5.5. Let's keep it there. And the developer can add a doc type, and that will get them the higher standards compliance that we just built. So two different engines, and the developer got to choose. Here's the problem with that theory. I have traveled the world. I've worked with over 300 customers in, well, I wouldn't say every country, but I think my total now is like 37 different countries worldwide, every continent. And the number of developers I've spoken to who understand what a doc type is and how it works has thus far been 4 individual people who know what this thing is. So now we put all of this power in the hands of a group of folks who have no idea what this thing is. Instead, if their tool throws a doc type in, they have a doc type and they get standards mode. If their tool does not throw a doc type in, then they don't have standards mode and they have no idea why their sample isn't behaving the same way as what they're copying and pasting from the web. So that's kind of a bit of a challenge. Now, fortunately, these days, nearly every tool that's made throws doc types in, so it's only maintenance of existing code. When we went to IE7, we evolved IE6 standards to become IE7 standards. There are some breaking changes, but not many. So we didn't keep IE6 standards around. We just evolved it to become IE7 standards, so there would only be one standards and one quirks. And we did that primarily because nearly everyone at the time was using quirks mode. It's remarkable how much quirks mode is used. Quirks mode is the default. If I don't add a doc type, I get quirks mode. In the enterprise, 70% of websites within the typical enterprise run in quirks mode. What's more remarkable is on the public internet, and specifically on the top 1,000 most visited sites on the internet, 12% of them are in quirks mode. And on IE, that is a 1999 implementation of web standards, which is a little terrifying. So I just said a few minutes ago, hey, 7 standards didn't really break much coming from 6 standards. Well, then why is retiring IE6 so hard, if that's true? Right, we're still working on it. Where are we at? We're at 6.7% of the world is still using it. Here's an interesting statistic. I'm still using math, aren't I? But this is a true statistic. The biggest challenge we see is that we fixed a bug. Right? So a doc type declaration with whatever goes behind it is what tells you you're in standards mode. In IE6, we had a bug where if the doc type wasn't the very first line of markup in your code, IE6 never read it. And since it never read it, it defaulted to quirks mode. Well, guess what? If I write XHTML, the very first line of markup is always an XML declaration, which means on IE6, 100% of all XHTML documents are running quirks mode. We fixed the bug because you can't very well have the switch that puts you into standards compliance mode not itself be standards compliant. That's a bit of a paradox. So we fixed the bug. And in doing so, we promoted every XHTML document as well as every other document that didn't put doctype first. We promoted them to standards mode, and they'd never been run that way before. And that's what broke them. That accounts for on the order of 85 to 90% of all issues upgrading from IE6 to IE7 or later. It was because of that number that I was able to get added as a hotfix for IE8 and as part of IE9, so they could actually bake it in and not make it a hotfix. So in IE8, you've got to ask for it from your account manager. In IE9, you just get it. The compatibility view added a new policy that says, yep, these are the ones that need quirks mode, since that will fix potentially 85 to 90% of all of the bugs you come across. That way you don't have to touch them manually, because I know that group policy is a lot easier. That's one of the interesting things I've noticed working with customer after customer, is that there's this huge divide. The team that runs the desktop and that runs the client is a different group than the developers, and it's a different group than the people who run the servers. And all three of them never talk to each other and don't have good relationships, and they can't go and modify things on their server without really long, 30-page-long explanations about why that's the only way to get it done. But that's one of the challenges we face. So back to our list. We've got 5 standards and 7 standards. When we introduced IE8, we really had a very renewed focus on standards. IE7 was really just, hey, we have a team again. What happened to the team? Let's rewind and do a little history lesson on that, because this is not terribly well known. We don't really talk about it. But back in 2001, after we shipped IE6, what were we investing in? Well, we had written what we called DHTML, and you may have noticed we're not always good at coming up with names. DHTML, not a very sexy name. Didn't get a lot of following, not a lot of use, but we loved the idea of code and markup together to build UI. So that team said, well, that was kind of a flop. That didn't work out so well. We introduced it for IE4 back in 97. It's been 5 years. No one's using it yet. Let's go further in a different direction. And they went on to create WPF, code plus markup, which went on to become Silverlight, which went on to become XAML in Windows 8 apps. So the idea carried forward. It just left the browser. The team building the UI for the browser was competing against not browser competition, because there really wasn't one. The web war had been won. Who was the number one person to contest? The number one way to get onto the internet in 2001 was America Online. That was who was perceived as the competition. So they went on to make the MSN browser as opposed to modifying IE. And no one was left watching over IE anymore. And as a result, it kind of got a little stale. So IE7 was all about let's just get IE back on its feet again. And IE8 was all about let's get standards right, established standards, HTML4, CSS 2.1. Let's get our compliance high to be competitive. It was so breaking because implementing standards means no longer implementing it the old way. It's change, and change means stuff breaks. So we left both of the modes we had in 7 and added a third one for 8. In IE9, it was all about emerging standards, HTML5. Well, that's different from HTML4. potentially some breaking changes, so we left all three of the existing ones and added a new one for IE9. For IE10, we added not one, but two more. HTML5 is not done. It was originally scheduled to be done around 2022. That may come faster now, because there's a lot of people investing in it. But more of it has become stable, so we added a new IE10 standards. And also, just for fun, we added a new quirks mode. And it's actually more than just for fun. It's because same markup matters. So if I go to a website that is designed by academia, right, runs great on Firefox, and what they noticed is when they put it out to folks who weren't using Firefox, that it didn't show up correctly. You'll notice on IE10 it does. The reason why is that they have a doc type that specifies HTML4 transitional. The HTML4 transitional doc type, again, no one really understands the subtleties of doc type, requires you to put the URL to the spec, which they did not do, which means they get quirks mode. The quirks mode on Firefox is different from the quirks mode we did. Our goal is behave like IE5. Their goal is, well, just behave like we used to and don't put any changes in. Different baselines. So we made a new quirks mode designed to behave like other browsers' quirks modes. When we had IE5 quirks, it behaved differently. Right? You can't see it too well. I mean, you can kind of see that this is slid off the top of the screen. It's not terribly problematic. The actual forms, if you were to try to submit for a conference session, were horribly broken, but because the conference was about a year and a half ago, the forms are no longer up. But it breaks in all kinds of ways. So we made a new quirks mode so that the internet and the same markup would behave the same on IE as it does on Firefox, as it does on Chrome, regardless of whether they're in quirks mode or standards mode. That's why we did it. Here's what it means to the enterprise. Now you have two quirks modes. What you will get by default, sites that are in my local intranet zone will default to compatibility view. Compatibility view is either 7 standards or 5 quirks. That means your existing quirks mode sites that were running in 5 quirks on IE 7 or 8 or 9 or even 6 will continue to get IE 5 quirks on IE 10. However, if your website is running in the internet zone, the default will be this new interoperable quirks, and your site may break. The fix would be to ask for IE5 quirks either at the page level or by getting it into the local intranet zone. And so, let me do a search here. I put together an article on my blog, and there's a shortcut you can use, which is appcompatguy.com. It will redirect you to the site. I just find it easier to remember. That talks about building durable web applications by leveraging the ability of someone to add a meta tag or a header that indicates what you're compatible with. If you tell IE which browser engine you want to use, IE will read that and use it. I also put in some guidance because a lot of people say, nope, it doesn't work for me. When it doesn't work, there's usually two things I find out. Either they've done it wrong or they've done it too late. As soon as you put a script on there, we have to determine the engine we're using, so we call it based on the defaults. If you come along later and give us a meta tag, it's too late. We can't change now. If you put in markup, we start doing a layout. You try to change it later, it's too late. But with this, you can actually get a lot done. So really important to understand, IE9 has 4 ways to render a page. IE10 has 6. You can choose either at the header, which requires you to have access to the web server, or at the meta tag level, which requires you to have access to the page. We don't yet have the ability to do all of the same things with group policy. I continue to ask for it because it becomes more and more valuable as we get more document modes. But today you are restricted to only compat view, which is 7 standards or 5 quirks, or 5 quirks. And those are your only choices through group policy today. If that's a problem, please send me mail. I'm appcompatguy@microsoft.com, and tell me your case so I can forward that to the team and express the urgency whether that matters to you. So with that in mind, let's look at some broken apps. So a lot of the challenges we see today are not about IE just doesn't do it anymore, particularly with IE10. IE10 implements a lot more of HTML5, addressing all the critical gaps, implementing as many of the stable standards as we think is reasonable. And that's a choice that's always hard to make. As soon as we don't implement something, people start saying, wow, IE sucks, because they don't implement this thing, and this thing is the greatest feature ever, and everyone ought to have it. But then if we implement it and the standard is changing, change means existing sites break when the next change happens. So if it's fluctuating and hasn't settled down and we implement it here, and then it changes to become this other thing, all the sites you built for IE 10 stop working on the next IE, or the next IE, or the next IE, because it's changing. And change means breaks. That's a problem. And so because, you know, we've got this sort of schizophrenic thing, we implement more and more, but now what we're seeing is people who say, oh, I don't like what you are. Why don't you try any other browser? And you'll be happier. Turns out that you don't actually need to try any other browser. You just need to pretend to be another browser in order to work. So back into the F12 tools. Really useful for troubleshooting, right? The first thing I do is I start trying different document modes and fiddling around here. But in this case, it's saying, please be another browser. In the Tools menu, I have the ability to change my user agent string and tell it, hello, I'm Chrome. And then when I refresh the page, I'll find out that there's actually not a problem with IE functioning on this page. It turns out that the page is a little bit slow, by the way. Turns out that IE renders the page just fine. It's just that the people who wrote the page are jerks and refuse to run for no valid technical reason. There's nothing broken about this page on IE. IE's only crime is being named the same thing as IE6. That's their crime. So we have that problem. It's flat out version checks. Another challenge is that because we have a little bit of a schizophrenic browser. Oh, don't work on me now. I'm doing these incidentally on all live web pages, and sometimes they behave erratically. It does make it more fun. There we go. All right, got the bug. Here's the interesting challenge that we find. They're load balanced, and some of their servers have actually been updated. And so now I'm starting to get intermittent repros. But here's what their problem. They're actually doing something that we would recommend. They're going in, and they're trying to create an element. So they're doing some browser detection, but they're trying to create it. And here's whether they see if it works or not. They try to say, OK, well, let's try and take a look at what we're doing here, and did we manage to create this element? And if I dig into this element, it turns out to be an HTML5 element. It's a canvas. And they look to see whether the canvas got created. It's called testing for features, not testing for browser version. A best practice. But they hit one problem. Up at the very beginning, they added this meta tag. That's the XUA compatible tag. Please behave as if you were IE7. So here's where they got into trouble. I want to do an HTML5 element. Give me some HTML5. Oh, but before you do, pretend to be a non-HTML5 compliant browser. And then they'll find that since we're not behaving like an HTML5 browser, we don't create the element because IE7 didn't have HTML5, and then they fail out. That's the problem. All right, so what's the fix? Stop asking us to behave like IE7. If I were to simply go up into standards mode, it'll refresh and work correctly. There's nothing broken about it, other than we're pretending to be something in which it doesn't work. Now, I like to infer good feelings on people. I don't think they did this to be jerks. Here's what probably happened. I'm guessing they started writing this in the IE8 era, because that wasn't that long ago. IE9 was last year. IE8 did not do HTML5 Canvas. So here's what they probably did. Let's make a Canvas website. Oh, it's not working on IE. I wonder why. Let's look on the documentation. Oh, the documentation says, try this to make more things work. So they tried it, and it still didn't work. So then they just left it there and said, all right, well, I'll put up a warning and try to help my IE users and suggest they try something else. And they just never went back and took it back out. So in essence, they're breaking their own site by asking for it to be broken. So far, we haven't seen anything actually broken, other than that we can't fix it simply by pretending to be something else. Oh, here's another site that does. Oh, no. Always close the browser after you've been fiddling with that document mode, because otherwise that document mode is sticky. Here's one I'm troubleshooting and I'm watching. This was supposed to have been fixed, well, a week ago, and now it was again supposed to have been fixed yesterday. Fortunately for my demo, it's still not fixed. This is another problem. So I'll show you another aspect of the tools, which is if I have an application that's failing, the console output can give me some useful information. So let me refresh to get the console output, and it's going to clue me right in to what the problem is. It's on the compatibility view list. Here's also what happened. So weightwatchers.com wasn't working on IE8 or IE9 unless we put it in the compatibility view. So then the developer said, we're going to build a brand new website using HTML5 to make a great experience for browsers, right, for anyone who doesn't have an installed app, so we can get a great mobile experience. But they had no idea that there was such a thing as the compatibility view list, and they have no idea that there is such a thing as XUA compatible, and as a result, they have no idea why it's broken, so they, on their website, say it probably doesn't work on Windows Mobile. So they also have no idea that we now call it Windows Phone. And it turns out to work just fine if it's not in compatibility view. So the fix that I have in place, well, I asked them to add XUA compatible. I have yet to get them to do that or understand what that is because I don't know them personally. So I asked our guys to take them off of the compatibility view list that was supposed to go live on the 28th. It didn't. There was a bug. The bug was supposed to be fixed by the 6th. That was yesterday. So clearly they haven't figured out how to fix that bug yet. I'm starting to get irritated. But that is another potential problem with rendering. Let's debug one where we actually have to change some code so I can show you another great tool. Let's see if this one is still broken. It is still broken. So this is a website that's used at nearly every healthcare organization I've spoken to. It's GE Centricity Web. And they may have a fix in place now, but this is it's one that's implemented on-premise by hospitals. And so hospitals do very, very thorough testing because this is what they use to check the radiology data. So it's real important that this works, right? If you go in and get an MRI or some kind of scan, doctors use this application to go and view it. And I've gotten to know this application really well because I have thus far fixed it for IE8, IE9, and IE10. So three different times I've had to go through and provide solutions. And I was a little frustrated to hit the same problem in IE10 as I had for IE9. There's recordings of me solving this for IE9, so you may be surprised that I have to go in and fix it again. Let's take a look at what happens. So I'm going to introduce the other tool that I like to use for solving web application issues. This is a tool called Fiddler. Fiddler was written by Eric Lawrence, who used to work on the Internet Explorer team. He did this in his spare time because he's kind of a nerd, and so writing HTTP debugging proxies is what he does for fun. Kind of like how Mark Rusinovich writes things like Process Explorer on his spare time for fun. A really fun story on what nerds do for fun is I had a session I gave at one of our internal conferences called Hardcore Debugging, and I managed to talk Mark into coming on stage. What he decided to do for fun was to jailbreak his Surface and then hack the kernel so that he could change the blue screen of death to a pink screen of death. This is what nerds do for fun. Right, so he wrote this for fun, and what it does is it injects itself into WinInet as a proxy server so that you can watch all of the traffic going by. So if I refresh this page, I can see all of the web traffic that's going through. Oh, that's terrific. Oh, yeah, I still have it on here. Let me delete that. Let me refresh that again. All right. And I'm not going to go through the process of finding the document itself, but instead I'm going to say, you know what, let's just go right into the source of the problem, which is this check is implemented in a JavaScript called checks.js. So from Fiddler, I can take my response and save it. I'm just going to take the response body and drop it on my desktop. And that lets me go in with a proper text editor and take a look at what's happening. Now, conveniently, I just had this open yesterday, so it zooms right to where the source of the problem is. I just did a search for the string that they're showing because it's fairly unique. So here's the problem that they had for IE9. The version of the JavaScript engine that we had for IE6, for IE7, for IE8 was 5.6 every single time. It never changed. For IE9, we completely redid the JavaScript engine. It's the Chakra JavaScript engine. Way, way better performance. It does JIT compilation now, which it never did before, so it's no longer interpreting. It can be orders of magnitude faster. And in doing so, we gave it a new version. Here's their check. The major version is less than 5, or the minor version is less than 5, then say that there's a problem. Well, what's wrong with that check? Well, if I'm 5.4, right, major version is not less than 5, but the minor version is, so it won't run for that. It'll say, yep, you need at least 5.6, right? It's not sufficient, if you will. Right, but what happens when I go to 9.0? Is 9 less than 5? Nope, that's good. Is 0 less than 5? Yes. Oh, I failed. They're trying to do the right thing. They just wrote it wrong. And it turns out I don't have a lie for that built into the browser. I have to change the code. Right? When I look at the customers who've gone from IE8 to IE9 or to IE10, the number of times I've had a problem where I have not been able to fix it using the built-in compatibility of the browser has been, since the day we shipped it, 4 apps. And this is one of them. So your likelihood of being able to leverage what's built in is high, but not perfect. So you do sometimes have to get someone to change some code. So here's the problem. Now, this problem turns out to be really, really problematic. And it's this pattern. People just write this check poorly. They don't think about it. It passes on everything that exists at the time. In fact, that's the reason behind why we number Windows versions the way we do now. Because Windows XP is version 5.1. So why is Windows 7 6.1 and not 7.0? Because 0 is less than 1 and would fail in poorly written XP check. 1 is greater than or equal to 1 and would pass it. That's why it's 6.1. That's also why Windows 8 is 6.2, because 6 is greater than or equal to 5, and 2 is greater than or equal to 1, so it passes all of those legacy XP checks. In fact, no one gets to decide the version of the Windows version itself in the OS except for the AppCompat team. Marketing doesn't get to choose it. Engineering doesn't get to choose it. AppCompat gets to choose it because checks like this are written poorly. So I suggested to them the way that they ought to write it, right? This is this check written correctly, which would be if the major version is less than 5, or the major version equals 5, and the minor version is less than 5. That means anything greater than 5 will get an automatic free pass, because that's what they're trying to exclude. That's how they should have written. And I specified that not only in the email that I sent to them directly, in the email that I sent through my doctor friend who works at the hospital whose website I'm so rudely displaying right now, as well as in publicly viewed recordings at various tech eds over the course of the past year and a half or so, in addition to speaking with the developer team themselves at Tech Ed North America last year and giving them this code on many occasions. Despite that, for some reason they wrote this code. So let's dissect this. All right, so the major version is equal to 9.0, right? So the major version's an integer. So for the low, low cost of a boxing and unboxing operation, I need to transition both to float so I can actually do a comparison and find that that will pass. And then I have an OR with the minor version equals 9.0. Well, the minor version will never, ever be 9.0, so that will always fail. Which means that I'm doing some extra unnecessary boxing on IE10 and still not getting any good outcomes. And so, had they just written what I wrote, it would work correctly. Now that's my theory. It would work correctly. I think I've written it right. How do I prove that? Do you think that Northwestern Memorial Hospital, so Northwestern is a teaching institution, right? It's one of the top universities in the U.S., right? So I'm not as good as universities over here in Europe. I understand that. We got a couple good ones. Top university with managing their health data, they're not going to let me modify their production website ever. So what do I do? That's the other magic of Fiddler. Right, so with Fiddler, I can also say every time I get a request for this website, replace it. And instead, give this file. So now, without having to modify a production server, I can test a fix and prove that I'm right or wrong before I send it off. And I always do this before I send someone a code fix to make sure that it actually fixes the problem. Because remember that divide before? The server team and the client team, they're different teams. They don't talk to each other very much, right? If I send the server team a fix and they apply it and it doesn't work, are they going to help me the next time? Probably not. So it behooves me to test it. Now, just to make things super interesting, they also timestamp it every single time they send it, which means I have to actually do a regular expression match on everything that is checks.js and save it, and then go ahead and refresh the page. And what I'll find is that by writing it correctly, oh, that's kind of weird. That's very strange. Well, it works correctly. It's not laying out correctly anymore. So, what you do in a troubleshooting session, but troubleshoot it. This is the unintended debugging demo. This is sitting inside of a div. And so this is to a margin top, right? I have no idea why that's being Table width. Huh. That didn't help. What is this? Let's try switching out. Nope, that didn't work. There we go. Ah, it's a Quirks Mode site. That would explain it. So now we get past it. And now it works correctly. And it gets to the next check, which says ActiveX, right? And at this point, I'm like, all right, it looks like you're not very good at writing code, so I'm going to go ahead and take a pass on installing your ActiveX controls for now. I am assured that they do, in fact, work, but that's the general process. Other sort of related fixes, kind of the one big challenge now, and then we'll move on and do a couple minutes of Windows apps. I think that's also important. Also on the topic of version checks. Why do I keep talking about version checks? Because that's what you're finding today. Right? Now, if you wanted to learn a couple of things to make you effective, there, I've got recordings of similar sessions from tech eds in the past that really delve into a couple of shims that are really powerful for fixing Windows apps, right? Correct file paths and virtual registry are incredibly powerful. And I strongly recommend that you download the Stock Viewer shim demo application, which has a guide for walking through it to help you understand your power for building Windows apps. Above and beyond that, today's focus is all about version checks because that's where the bugs are. Right, so let me go ahead and... All right, so here's a website. And I'm going to... Got my DevTools open, browse to accounts, and it's going to have a problem, and I can show you an error that I'm seeing all the time. Lots of things like to check what version are you, right? The user agent string has a rather inconvenient property of being a string. A string has to be converted to a number to do a numerical check. How did they do it in this case and in many other cases? They said, all right, pick a number between 0 and 9 because there will never be a version 10 of IE. That's inconceivable, right? And so they're thinking that you're running IE1 because the very first number you come across is a 1 when it comes to a 1 and a 0, and they have no idea that you're actually a 10, and they didn't convert you. This is, in fact, so widespread and problematic. See, now there's a good old-fashioned sign. That this even happened on a little platform you may have heard of called ASP.NET. So here's a good thing to be on the lookout for. Remember how I told you about the console and just watching things go by can help you troubleshoot? If you are going to IE10, here's the one to look for. __ do post back. If that is breaking, you have an unpatched ASP.NET. The solution is to patch ASP.NET. I have now learned reflexively. Oh, what's the problem? Let me just go ahead and hit F12 and find out. Now, if this is blocking you from doing something, right? In my case, my internet provider had an unpatched ASP.NET, and that's how I pay my bill. I could either go and find some stamps in my house and pay it by mail, but I'm way too lazy for that. In the interim, if you need to get past something, this doc mode tells you how you're going to lay out a page. That's interesting. What's this thing next to it? Browser mode does not talk about how you lay out a page. Browser mode changes what version of the browser you're saying you are. So if you go to browser mode compatibility view, then you will say, hello, I'm IE7. But you will leave a little nugget of evidence that says, oh, you know what, I'm actually IE10. Right, and you can see the difference. If I go to the user agent string, here I am with an IE10 user agent string. If I change the browser mode to compat view, it says I'm IE7, but it does leave Trident 6.0 in there. So I can see, oh, yeah, you know what? That's actually IE10. I can get past the mystery. Whereas if I actually David an IE7 user agent string, which never happens in real life, it only happens in the dev tools, then it wouldn't leave that evidence. In real life, it's one of these two things. But I can switch to, say, hey, I'm IE9, and get past the ASP.NET bug. All right, so another bit of evidence. I see do post back if I change the browser mode or change the user agent string through this option and it starts working, another bit of evidence that that's probably the problem. And I can go and fix it. Last but not least, I'll point out real quick a couple of resources that we have. All right, we just introduced this a little while ago, a site called modern.ie. And what modern.ie will do is give you some tools to scan a web page to see what kind of work you would need to do in order to upgrade to a more modern browser. And I'll test it against a site that's being used that I know, at least as of yesterday, didn't have the right thing. But here's the reason why you might consider something like this. I like you to be able to keep your applications as they are without modification so that you don't have to invest the money. But sometimes you may want to invest the money modernizing things, and here's one reason why. If I run a web page in either Quirks mode or IE7 mode, look what happens to my JavaScript performance. My sites are 10 times slower than they otherwise would be. So I could potentially upgrade to a modern version and get a 10x performance increase. That's potentially really significant. And this site can help me figure out why. In this case, they happen to be using an old version of jQuery. That's one bit of advice I like to give you is jQuery is middleware. Manage it like middleware. What most developers do is when the day they start their project, they go to jQuery.com. They download the .js file. And they never touch it again. So whatever it was that day, the older the app, the older the jQuery version, the fewer browsers it's going to work on because they update jQuery to support new browsers and fix those bugs. In the Windows apps, wow, I have 3 minutes left. Wow, I've been debugging too much. Let me real quick show you one of the big changes for Windows 8. Potentially different from what you were for Windows 7, right? So in Windows 8, this is going to ask to be an admin. That's I can go ahead and get past it, right? And then if I go and say, oh, go into options, I'm going to get this error. And it turns out that both of those are errors that I can fix using shims. Shims are a way to provide operating system fixes targeted at a particular application. And this is all documented in the Stock Viewer Lab Guide. So I know I'm kind of fast-forwarding through this because I want to get to the point, which I think is something that's not in the Lab Guide. So Program Files, x86, Stock Viewer, and then StockViewer.exe. And then what I'll do is I will apply Force Admin Access. And what Force Admin Access will do is it will pretend to be an admin. I will also apply virtualize HKCR Lite because that fixes the other bug. Right, and this would have worked on Windows 7. So I'll create this SDB. I'm going to install it locally. And that's going to get me past the admin check. So that shim worked. But the other one didn't fix it. And it would have fixed it on Windows 7. What's happening is that we modify the way the shim engine works to have it exclude managed code. Stock Viewer is a Windows Forms application. So if you have shimmed Windows Forms application, some of those shims will no longer work like they did on Windows 7. For Force Admin Access, it works because the shim itself chooses to include the .NET framework. But virtualize HKCR Lite does not. So in order to continue fixing that application, I would have to go in and add, well, for a quick and dirty check, I can add all modules. reinstall it, and now it will shim everything, including the framework, which means I make that bug go away. So there is one difference in how shims work. Other than that, it behaves the way it did on Windows 7. So with that, I have run myself out of time, even though I could have lots more fun debugging with all of you. Thanks so much for coming out, and hopefully you have a great rest of the show.